So thank you very much for the introduction. It's a pleasure to be here, and I appreciate the invitation. Right, so it's a rather long title. Basically, what I will talk about is a specific type of inflation driven by a pseudo-scalar field, and the rich phenomenology which results from those inflationary models. Okay, and this talk is based on work in collaboration with two fellow people at MPIK in Heidelberg, Daniel Jimenez, who's a master student right now, and this has also been part of his master thesis, actually, and Xunji Xu, another postdoc at MPIK, as well as a collaboration with Koi Kamada, who's right now a postdoc at Arizona State University. Okay, so on the very first slide, I already want to show to you the messages that I want you to take home from this talk. So I will talk about inflation driven by a pseudo-scalar field or axion, if you want, which I will denote by A. And I will assume that this inflaton field, the axion, is coupled to gauge fields, namely the hypercharge gauge field in the standard model. And the way this coupling will look like is of this form. It's part of the effect of Lagrangian. And I will assume that the axion, the inflaton field, couples via such a high dimension operator to the field strength tensor of the standard model hypercharge and the dual field strength tensor. And well, the interesting observation is that once this coupling is present during inflation, you will run into a very rich phenomenology. And in this talk, I will basically focus on three main things, which I've listed here. So first of all, as a very important consequence of this coupling, we'll encounter explosive production of those gauge fields during inflation and towards the end of inflation. And this will provide us with a mechanism of primordial magnetogenesis, a possibility to generate primordial magnetic, hypermagnetic fields in the early universe. Okay, so then once we've got those fields, we can use them actually for another mechanism. Those fields will turn out to be maximally helical. They'll have a maximal helicity, and that enables us to implement a certain mechanism to generate the baryon asymmetry of the universe. We can implement baryogenesis via the chiral anomaly in the standard model. Okay, and then finally, this entire production mechanism of gauge fields will leave also its imprint in the power spectrum, tensor and scalar power spectrum of primordial perturbations, and this will give us a signal or a signature in the stochastic spectrum of primordial gravitational waves. And that would eventually be some possibility to test this model. Okay, so the goal of this talk is to basically go through this list of phenomena and eventually study the compatibility and the correlation of these phenomena and see where in parameter space everything comes out consistent. Okay. So that's the outline of my talk. First, I will talk about the basics of inflation, then discuss the mechanism of magnetogenesis, show how the magnetic fields can be used for baryogenesis, and finally, I will show how this leaves a signature in the background of gravitational waves. Okay, let's get started with pseudoscalar inflation. I think you're all familiar with the basic idea behind inflation that denotes a stage of accelerated expansion in the early universe. Inflation has been invented or served the purpose to explain the size, the homogeneity, and the isotropy of our universe as we observe it on cosmological scales. But the nice feature about inflation is that it has also an inbuilt mechanism to generate fluctuations. Quantum fluctuations during inflation are stretched to a large size, and eventually they act as seeds for structure formation on galactic scales. Okay, so inflation, however, is not a unique single precisely defined theory. It's more like a framework, an idea of what could have been happening in the early universe. There's a plethora of different inflation models in the literature. That's, for instance, illustrated here in this Planck, in this plot by the Planck collaboration. We see exclusion contours by the Planck satellite on important observables, which you can infer from the cosmic microwave background. And the Planck people also put predictions into this plot for different inflationary models. And I think basically for any point within those contours, you should be able to find at least one model or many more models that just precisely predicts those numbers. Okay, so I think it's fair to say that at present there's no consensus on how to embed inflation into particle physics, how to make contact between this idea of inflation and concrete models of particle physics. Moreover, it's an important question how one could possibly test specific models of inflation beyond their predictions for the CMB, as we see it here in this plot. Okay, and at that point, I'd like to come to the observation of gravitational waves from binary black hole mergers by the LIGO-Virgo collaboration. By now, we have entered into the era of gravitational wave astronomy, and gravitational waves now promise to open up a new observational window on the early universe. And well, in the wake of the LIGO discovery, many authors have become interested again in the possibility to generate sizable gravitational waves from inflation. Here I'm just giving one example. That's a study by Domke et al. From last year. They study different equivalence classes of inflationary models, and then depending on the parameters in the model, you can enhance the vacuum contribution to the gravitational wave spectrum to large values, so that they become eventually into reach of upcoming experiments. Yeah, so those would be the sensitivities for ELISA or the sensitivity reach of advanced LIGO. Okay. Similarly, as LIGO has observed gravitational waves from black hole mergers, people now seriously also consider the possibility that those black holes have a primordial origin, that they correspond to primordial black holes which have been generated, which have been created during inflation. And that's something that's also been seriously studied here. I'm just showing a plot by García Bilido, Peloso, and Una from June this year. And then they study the gravitational wave spectrum associated with the production of primordial black holes during inflation. So there is hope that those new observational tools will help us to probe inflationary models in an additional way, in addition to the CMB. Okay, so in this talk, I will focus on a specific class of inflationary models, namely inflation driven by a pseudoscalar field, or because the prototype of such a pseudoscalar field is nothing but the QCD axion. You can also refer to it as an axion-like particle, ALP, or simply axion for short. Okay, so in field theory, such pseudoscalar fields naturally appear as pseudo-number Goldstone bosons of spontaneously broken global symmetries. In string theory, you also often encounter axions where they correspond to scalar modes with a shift symmetry that survives after compactifying the internal space. Now, the nice feature about such pseudoscalar axion-like fields is that they exhibit this shift symmetry, which naturally protects the their scalar potential. So they correspond to flat directions in field space. They can basically evolve over large field ranges, and then they serve as natural candidates for driving inflation. Okay, so if our axion field is such a pseudo-number Goldstone boson of a global symmetry, this global symmetry might be anomalous under some gauge symmetry. And if that's the case, then this anomaly of our global symmetry will imply that the axion couples to the gauge fields of that local symmetry. So once you make the assumption that inflation is driven by an axion-like field, it's just natural to assume that there is also such couplings of your inflaton field to gauge fields. And those gauge fields may either be part of the standard model or part of some hidden sector. Okay. And that's a nice feature, actually, of those axion inflation models, because then you get all those phenomenological implications, as I will discuss in the following. Once this coupling is present, you can generate magnetic fields, you can use them for baryogenesis, and eventually you can test it in, looking at the gravitational wave background. Okay. So
do you have in mind that something like the inflaton is pseudoscalar?
That's right.
Wouldn't such a thing create a universe in which penalty is violated?
Well, it is violated during inflation.
By big amounts in the entire universe.
That's true. I mean, this is what we will see on the next slide. I mean, you use that parity violation actually to produce those gauge fields with a certain helicity. But at the end of inflation, the axion simply settles in the true vacuum.
But in our universe, we see parity violation
with. Okay, but I mean, that's what's happening after inflation, right? I mean, after inflation, that source of parity violation is gone.
I mean, the universe is created. The parity
violated
universe. Well, space.
Yeah, but I think there's no problem with that, right? I mean, you do have parity violation.
Sure. I mean, that's why I'm asking. I feel like there is a problem.
I wouldn't see why, actually. I mean, you certainly have a source of parity violation during inflation, but that's gone after the end of inflation. And I mean, the axion is also gone eventually. But the axion is not around anymore after inflation, it just decays.
I asked the question, but.
Yeah. Maybe there's.
But he is going to tell us about really interesting observational consequences of dramatically violating parity during inflation.
But we don't see that.
We might. Yeah, that's true. But. I mean, we haven't observed those primordial magnetic fields, but if we could observe them, there might be signs of parity violation inherent to those fields. That would be some observable which could show us this primordial parity violation. Yeah, okay. Good. So, and again, in this talk, I will make another specific choice as far as the coupling of the inflaton is concerned. So I will assume that the inflaton couples to the gauge field of the standard model hypercharge, the U1 hypercharge, for various reasons. First of all, this gives us a minimal scenario because we couple the inflaton to an abelian gauge symmetry, which makes, at the technical level, the entire analysis simpler than in the non-abelian case. And also, the U1 hypercharge is already part of the standard model, so we don't have to invent any new hidden U1 gauge symmetry. Okay, but the more important reason is that, as I said, we expect that this coupling gives us a production of gauge fields during inflation. And if those gauge fields correspond to the U1 hypercharge, what we actually produce are hypermagnetic fields during inflation and at the end of inflation. So if the inflaton couples to the U1 hypercharge, this gives us an interesting opportunity for primordial magnetogenesis. And this could enable us to produce those primordial hypermagnetic fields. Okay, so speaking of magnetic fields, there are indications of magnetic fields in the cosmos on various length scales. We observe magnetic fields on scales of the size of the solar system, magnetic fields in galaxies, and there are indications for magnetic fields on the scale of galaxy clusters, intergalactic magnetic fields. Now, to explain the presence of such intergalactic magnetic fields, you want to have some seed fields from early times in the cosmological evolution. And in here, the idea of primordial magnetogenesis is that those primordial gauge fields generated during inflation, that they act as a seed for the intergalactic magnetic fields in galaxy clusters. So we would produce those primordial hypermagnetic fields at early times, during the electroweak phase transition at temperatures around 100 GeV, those hypermagnetic fields get converted into magnetic fields, and eventually they evolve to set the stage or to set the basis for the evolution of magnetic fields on the scale of galaxy clusters. In fact, in recent years there have been indications for intergalactic magnetic fields on the scale of galaxy clusters from observations of the gamma ray spectrum from blazars, a certain type of quasars. This does not correspond to any direct observation, it's just indirect evidence, but this indirect evidence points at intergalactic magnetic fields with a strength of the order of 10 to the minus 17 to 10 to the minus 14 Gauss. Okay, and here the idea would be that those intergalactic magnetic fields, they can be traced back to the primordial magnetic fields which have been generated during inflation. Okay, Now, how do we actually generate those fields? And then here I think parity violation plays an important role. Let me write down again the Lagrangian of the model. A denotes the axion, that's just the kinetic term. F is the field strength tensor of the hypercharged gauge field. V of A is the scalar potential of the axion, which we won't specify at this point here. And then we have our additional coupling, which the entire analysis is about. So, and once this coupling is present, it will modify the well-known equations of inflation in some crucial ways. So for instance, if we look at the Friedmann equation, there will be new contributions to the Friedmann equation on the right-hand side, which come from this additional coupling in the Lagrangian. Okay, so H is the Hubble rate, and in square brackets here, we have all contributions to the total energy density. First of all, the kinetic energy in the axion field, the potential energy of the axion field, but then also additional contributions which correspond to the energy stored in the electric, the hyperelectric field, and the energy stored in the hypermagnetic field. Okay, and also the equations of motion for the axion field, as well as the equation of motion for the gauge field, the vector field, are modified. Now we find additional source terms here on the right-hand side, which are induced by this additional coupling in the Lagrangian. Okay, and in particular, this term here acts as an additional friction term, similarly to the Hubble friction term. And if the production of gauge fields is strong enough during inflation, this term might eventually dominate and determine the time evolution of the field A during inflation.
So what is A prime?
Oh, that's a very good question. A dot is the time derivative with respect to ordinary coordinate time, and A dot and A prime is the time derivative with respect to conformal time.
What do the angle brackets mean?
That's the vacuum expectation value.
In what state?
Well, I mean, you want to match this to the Bunch-Davis vacuum at early times.
So I should think of the angle brackets as a quantum thing.
That's a quantum thing, that's right. What you do here is that at early times during inflation, you treat those fields as quantum fields, and the angle brackets denote quantum vacuum expectation values. And then the occupation numbers for the different momentum modes grow, and at the end of inflation, you want to match those vacuum expectation values with classical ensemble averages in a classical ensemble.
Yeah. My intuition should be that the angle brackets are small and the other things are big because the things are possible, these are quantum.
Well, I mean, that's... I mean, in the parameter region in which we'll solve those equations, these are always small contribution, that's true. I just know that other authors take the same equations of motion and then consider the case where the part on the right-hand side is dominating, and then still it's the quantum vacuum expectation value.
But you don't have to defend them.
Yeah, that's right. Now, I'm just thinking whether this is then inconsistent or so, but...
That does not play an important role.
That doesn't play any important role. I mean, the point is that, I mean, from this additional coupling here, we find new contributions to those equations, but we will always stay in the regime where those contribute small perturbations. It's not going to be any big effect. Okay, another question?
V of A is now the value of the potential.
That's right.
The boson is moving,
Sorry, say it again. That's...
What is V of A?
That's the scalar potential. That basically defines your inflationary model. Yeah, that's...
Sorry, I'm getting confused with the picture you have. Like you have, after the spontaneous breakdown of the potential, you're in the bottom of the, top
hat
or something like that.
That's right, yes.
And then you want that to have a little bit of a slope in order for the inflation to run.
That's true, yes. I mean, if you were at the bottom of the potential, with an exact shift symmetry, then you wouldn't have any axion field dependence in the scalar potential. Yeah, but then you assume that there are additional shift symmetry breaking effects which induce this scalar potential. Yeah, I mean, this Lagrangian basically corresponds to the very general framework of pseudoscalar inflation. You just consider inflation driven by a pseudoscalar field, and then if you want to become specific and consider a certain model, you would choose a certain function for this potential. I mean, in what's called natural inflation, this is usually given by a cosine potential.
So
That would be the typical scalar potential which you would expect for such a pseudo number Goldstone boson.
So I'm curious, in your calculations, what do you call the scale factor?
The scale factor? Sorry.
What is the scale factor? What symbol do you use?
No. The scale factor doesn't appear in those equations. I mean,
but if you use it, what do you call it?
Well, in the paper, we call it capital R. That's
okay.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good question. We had a long discussion in our collaboration which symbols we should use.
Yeah.
I don't know. In the end, I was a proponent of the idea of referring to the axion as A. Maybe that's confusing.
You pushed for A.
Yeah, I pushed for A. So A is the axion, and the scale factor is denoted by capital R. Okay? Yeah, I mean, I didn't write down R. It's sort of hidden here in the A prime. Okay? I could have also written that H is given as R dot over R. Okay, so the bottom line, literally, is that the axion gauge field coupling results in new source terms in those equations of motion here. And so because of this source term here on the right-hand side, gauge field modes of a certain helicity state, either positive or negative helicity, will get exponentially amplified. That's something you can also see here in this picture. The momentum modes start out here at the vacuum level. They simply oscillate, and then once the source term kicks in, one of the helicity modes, in this case the positive helicity mode, will experience an exponential amplification. Okay, and we can see this more explicitly if we look at the.
In that part, which way was time going?
Yeah, sorry, I was trying to show this with the hockey stick, but so it's from right to left. Yeah, so that's where this is early times, and then at later times the gauge field mode grows. Yeah, maybe that's counterintuitive. Yeah, okay. So time goes from right to left.
What is the behavior of little a of the axion?
Oh, I mean, at early times, and I think this is the regime in which we stay all the time. This will just contribute a small perturbation to the ordinary slow roll dynamics of the axion field. So it will do whatever it will do, whatever it does in the specific inflaton model.
Also for the axion.
Sorry?
You are assuming a slow roll dynamics for the axion.
That's true, yes. Yeah, I mean, the idea is that it's ordinary inflation driven by a pseudoscalar field supplemented by this additional term in the Lagrangian. Okay, so of course you must not choose the potential to be too steep. It has to be flat enough to support inflation.
And at the end of inflation, where does it go?
It decays. I mean, for instance, if we didn't talk about this additional coupling here in the Lagrangian, then you would have to write down a specific model of reheating and then specify how the axion couples to meta fields to see how the energy gets converted from the axion to meta fields. Here it's a bit easier because this term is around already anyway. So this opens up a decay channel for the axion after the end of inflation. This term will make it very easy for the axion to decay into gauge bosons doing reheating.
Start off, the axon rolls, and if I have a non-zero magnetic field, then box A is going to make something.
I think, as far as the instability is concerned, this is something we will see on the next slide, because here I'm showing explicitly the equation of motion for the vector field modes. So in the next step, now you can take your vector field, decompose it into momentum modes, Fourier modes, and then each of those Fourier modes will obey such an equation of motion. Okay, and then the effective frequency, which appears here, is a complicated function, not only of time, but also of some new parameter psi, which appears here. Okay, and so this frequency, omega squared, can turn negative, so this can give us some tachyonic instability in the equation of motion for the right values of psi and k and tau in this expression. Okay, psi is what I call the instability parameter, and that directly comes from this additional coupling in the Lagrangian. This comes from the right-hand side of this wave equation. Okay, so if you just look at this wave equation and then this term here, this term eventually is responsible for this piece here in the effective frequency of a momentum mode with wave number k.
And it's a dot, not a prime inside, right?
Now it's a dot, that's right. You're very careful. I mean, I was trying to avoid the scale factor in those equations, that's why. On the previous... Oh, yeah, here, yeah, I couldn't avoid it anymore. Okay, yeah, so there it is, yeah, okay, that's my scale factor r. Okay.
What size are you assuming for lambda?
Oh, that's a very good question. That's going to be one of the central questions in the study of the parameter space. In the end, we will get a very precise value or estimate of the scale lambda because we want to achieve successful baryogenesis. So I don't know whether I should spoil it right now and say the number. I mean, it's... yeah, you will be surprised. No, I mean, it's a factor 10 below the Planck scale. It's 3 times 10 to the 17 GeV. Yeah, so lambda needs to be rather large, actually, which means that the axis needs to be rather weakly coupled. And if it's that weakly coupled, we won't have overproduction of gauge fields, and we won't have overproduction of baryon number. So if lambda was smaller, the axon would be coupled more strongly, and that would give us overproduction of baryon number.
How big will C be?
Okay, now we're jumping ahead too fast. Yeah, so we'll come to this.
Just to tell us for the
order one.
Order one.
Yeah. Okay, but I mean, it's good that we're talking about Xi because, in addition, I mean, next to the Hubble rate, Xi will be the most important parameter of the entire analysis. I mean, because we stay as model independent as possible, we don't specify the scalar potential. There are just two parameters which are important to basically capture the entire physics of this scenario. So one is the Hubble rate, and the second important parameter is Xi, this instability parameter, which plays this important role here in the equation of motion for the vector field modes. Okay, so, and now, A dot is the axon velocity, the inflaton velocity during inflation, and well, we're working in the context of slow roll inflation, so we assume that A dot is a slowly varying quantity, so we can make the approximation that in this equation of motion, Xi is a constant, and for constant Xi in this equation of motion, we can solve it exactly. Then those vector field modes are given by certain hypergeometric functions, the Whittaker W functions, and that's the exact solution of this equation of motion for a constant parameter Xi. Okay?
So you're in stability frequency, like both k square time, but you have a k in the denominator, so it would be k.
That's right, yes.
Doesn't your mode grave like the exponent of the instability has a k in it? Why doesn't it have a k?
Is this instability? Sorry, where is the instability?
Well, the instability is captured here by this expression, yeah? So, I mean, I wrote it in this suggestive way because I want to have a dimensionless bracket which can be either positive or negative, okay? So I factored out k squared.
I get a k still in the denominator, so shouldn't that come in the exponent? It does have an exponent.
I mean, there still is a k dependence, right? I mean, there's a k dependence here in the Whittaker function, if that is what you're concerned about.
What I'm concerned about if you have UV.
Oh, that's a very good point. I mean, well, this is just the naive solution of this equation of motion. In the end, I mean, those are just the Fourier modes. And if we want to calculate something like those quantities down here, the total strength of the magnetic field, we again have to integrate over the momentum modes, and we impose a UV cutoff. Yeah, the point is that, well, only up to a certain k value, those modes develop an instability. And the very high frequency modes, they don't get unstable. Yeah.
So omega only when it's omega squared when it's negative is unstable, right?
That's right.
And it's only negative when it's smaller.
No, it depends on tau as well. So if tau.
Yeah, but the point is if k becomes very large, this thing will never become negative. So the highest frequency modes, they always stay at the vacuum level.
Okay. So you might let tau goes to zero? Is that right? Okay. So what happens if tau goes to zero?
And then I'm saying that you have a k over tau in the other term, so it takes over the other one.
Because psi should go to zero there, basically.
Yeah, that's my point. But place, and there should be a case where the denominator.
Where should be a K? There should be a, sorry, no.
Why should there be a case?
Because I don't want the exponent to have a K.
Yeah, maybe we can talk about this offline after the talk. I mean, well, that's, I think, an established result. If you, the point is that if you do two more manipulations to this equation here, then you can actually rewrite it as what is called the Whittaker differential equation. And then, well, it's a trivial statement to say that the solution is a Whittaker function. No, because you can just rewrite the equation of motion as a Whittaker equation. Okay, and then that's the form of the final solution. And then we see that, well, if psi is not too small, we'll get this exponential amplification here, in particular for the positive velocity modes, where we've got a plus sign here in the exponent. Okay, and as I said already, we can take this solution for the equation of motion and then go back to the actual magnetic field strength, which is given as curl A. We calculate the expectation value of B squared, the vector b squared, and the square root again, and that's our estimate for the typical strength of the magnetic field during inflation. Okay, and because everything up here only depends on basically two parameters, xi and h, also the final estimate for the hypermagnetic field strength is a function of xi and h. The energy scale is set by h squared, the Hubble rate squared, but then there is this prefactor which depends on xi and which can make this potentially large. Okay.
So regarding that, so the h squared is kind of what you would have expected for a quantum thing, so I understand that. And so if you did not have the exponential, then you would have said that the usual h squared will be small compared to your other scales, and that's what's making the classical approximation a good one. But does that mean that I should be thinking that there's a e to the pi c cannot be bigger, the product of e to the pi c times h squared divided by a Planck square or whatever the scale is, has to be less than an order of one to believe that you have to control over?
Yeah, I think that's an important issue which has to be addressed in those studies of axion inflation. You want to think about where your perturbative description breaks down, and there are various analyses regarding this question from last year and this year, and basically the story goes like that people put different constraints on the parameter xi. So they say perturbativity is respected for xi values up to 5 or xi values up to 4. But I think the precise numbers are still under debate.
But we're not going to go anywhere near that in any
case. Well, I mean, xi is always going to be order 1. So if I choose a value xi 4, then that's not too far away from xi equals 5. But yeah, I mean, certainly we won't go to much larger values. Yeah, yeah. And I think it's, I mean, that's something which has been, which is being studied by many authors at the moment. And I think those precise numbers are still in a debate. So I think there's no single value which you can take as the precise upper bound on xi from the requirement of perturbativity.
But to the extent that you're starting to get an enormous effect, that's when things start to smell bad, probably. Is that right?
I mean, people still use the same estimates, maybe in a too naive way, and then make statements about the spectrum of gravitational waves, which comes out of it. And then there are other authors which criticize that and say that it doesn't comply with their analysis of perturbativity. So I think it's still an ongoing debate. Okay, good. So yeah, and so here that's our estimate of the magnetic field strength. And at the same time, I also want to estimate the correlation length of those magnetic fields. Now those brackets, I'm going to tell you before you ask, those brackets denote an average of wavelengths, but the average it goes as follows here. I weight each mode, each wavelength, with the corresponding contribution to the total magnetic field strength. And then that's the estimate for the correlation length of the magnetic field. Again, it's a simple expression.
What is lambda?
Oh, that's supposed to be 2 pi over k. K is just the wave number here. Yeah, so what I do is a weighted average of 2 pi over k, and each factor of 2 pi over k, I weight with the respective contribution to this quantity here in momentum space. Okay, and the outcome is xi over h. So Again, those two parameters. Good. So this was just a quick overview of how we generate those magnetic fields during inflation. But then to make contact with observations in the present epoch, you have to study and describe the evolution of the gauge fields after inflation. And what we do in our analysis is the following. We work in the approximation of instant reheating, which means we don't specify the dynamics of reheating, and basically we just skip this period altogether. The point is that to describe reheating more precisely, a more complicated numerical simulation would be required based on magnetohydrodynamics. Also, to describe the further evolution of the gauge field after inflation, we use simple scaling laws. The outcome of this analysis is shown in those two plots here. So here I'm showing the evolution of the gauge field, the magnetic field strength B, as a function of decreasing temperature. Again, time goes from right to left, unfortunately. Okay, so we pick certain values for our parameters psi and h at early times, and then we can look at how those magnetic fields evolve, how the field strength decreases in the course of the expansion. And in this plot, I'm showing you the correlation length of the magnetic field, again, as a function of decreasing temperature. So at early times, at very high temperatures, the correlation length is small, and then as the temperature falls, as it drops, the correlation length increases. Okay, basically, this evolution can be divided into two different regimes. At early times, at high temperatures, both quantities simply are diluted adiabatically. The magnetic field strength drops like 1 of r squared, and the correlation length grows as 1 power of the scale factor. However, the interaction of the magnetic field with the charged plasma on small scales generates turbulence, both in the plasma and in the magnetic field. So in the end, you will have waves, plasma waves, propagating through the plasma that generates turbulence on a certain scale that's characterized by a certain length scale. VA is the so-called Alphane velocity. That's a quantity which appears in plasma physics. And once this turbulence scale has caught up with the correlation length, the system enters into the so-called inverse cascade regime, and from that point on, the correlation length simply continues to scale like the turbulence scale. That regime corresponds to the transfer of energy from low scales, where the turbulence is happening, to larger scales, and this slightly changes the redshifting behavior of those two quantities. In those plots, you can't even really see it. I mean, at those dashed lines here, the slope of those curves slightly changes. And then at lower temperatures, the system is in the inverse cascade regime. Okay, so this is how we connect our estimate of the magnetic field at very early times to a quantity which could, in principle, be observed today. Okay, good. And then that's the final.
You have to finish, so there's one more question I have.
Yes, sure.
So in your instability thing.
Yes.
The way I'm thinking about this, so tell me if this is wrong, is it's like a spinorbital decomposition or something that you've got some range of momenta are going unstable, so that the field is going to start developing a position dependent.
I think that's a valid picture. I mean, the point is that we encounter here such a tachyonic instability, and I think this is what usually happens if you have such a spinodal decomposition in the system.
But I'm thinking that you're getting large electric and magnetic fields, and so then the question is you know, we talked about before, is once you start getting the large electric fields, why aren't, you know, in inflation, I'm not sure quite how it works out, but you probably know better than I do. You know, so why don't charges like electrons start to short out those fields and change the dynamic in a way?
Yeah, so I think, I mean, we talked about this already. I mean, well, from the same analysis, you can also predict the strength of the electric field during inflation. And I think then it's an interesting question to see whether pair production in the electric field happens at a rate which is faster than the expansion rate. If that should be the case, then during inflation, the system should reach a state of thermal equilibrium. You would expect that your inflationary system thermalizes. And just last month, or 2 months ago, in June, there was a paper by Ferrara and Notari, thermalized axion inflation, and they make a claim that in certain parts of this parameter, say, parameter space, you actually see how the system thermalizes. But after that, there has already been a response by other authors who say that their criterion for thermalization is not appropriate, and you would actually not expect to see such a thermalized system. So I think somewhere in the parameter space should be possible to have such a strong particle production even during inflation. But I think, it's again under debate for which parameters this actually happens.
They look at production of electrons or other fields?
Well, I mean, in that case, if we couple our axion field to the standard model hypercharge, you would expect that this should impact every particle, every species that is charged on a hyper.
So the lightest particle would be the one that was possible.
Well, I mean, those particles don't have vacuum masses at the point anyway, right? I mean, that's way before electroweak symmetry breaking. Yeah, I mean, well, the point is, I mean, once you reach a thermal state, once the system thermalizes, then they obtain thermal masses. That's what.
This thermalization thing, I'm not entirely sure why it should term. I mean, I think the statement is that if you have large electric fields, you have large particle production. Of course, during inflation, they also would dilute. So
that's exactly my point. Yeah. So I mean, to make a precise statement about this, you have to compare different rates. You have to compare that rate of particle production with the expansion rate.
Yeah, and does drain your electric field, and that would.
Well, I mean, the electric field is not being drained in this setup during inflation. But I mean, after inflation, you will have reheating.
During inflation, it would be drained.
It does not be drained in your calculation because you didn't worry about further production, right? But the idea would be that if you did.
That's right, yeah. I mean, okay, so I think to make a more precise statement about this, you would have to see at what rate this is happening. And again, I mean, there has been a very recent proposal just 2 months ago where people claim that they see this effect of particle production in a certain part of parameter space. That's some very new, very recent.
So, I mean, this is something that we did a few years ago. And I mean, we did look at it, basically production of electrons. Essentially, all scenarios of magnetogenesis, if you had higher scale inflation, they were highly contrived or constrained, basically because of this effect that you basically produce electrons, obviously.
Even during inflation, that's what you're saying?
Especially during inflation. Like, I mean, it's not that you get too much particle. It's just that to produce magnetic field, you need electric field. And if your electric field, as soon as it basically is produced, it's drained, it basically loses all this energy to particles, then it cannot never get big enough. So that was basically, for lower scale inflation, it was fine, but for higher scale inflation, we find that basically this was trouble. Unless somehow your electron was very massive and you wouldn't produce.
Okay, well, I mean, this setup, the electron would not be massive. Yeah, so that would be a massless particle during inflation. Okay, I mean, maybe that's something that should be taken into account. Maybe that would justify some refinement of this analysis. Okay, I mean, I can just say that that's something in which in this calculation we did not take into account. The point also is, this might change the parameter dependence of the magnetic fields on those parameters from inflation. I think it doesn't really change the qualitative picture. So the statement is, as long as you're able to produce a sufficiently large magnetic field during inflation, you will be able to use that later on for baryogenesis.
That's exactly what I think NIOSH is aiming at, right? He's not going to give you the large magnetic field.
Well, if it always stays too small, I mean, if it doesn't surpass a certain threshold, then the entire scenario might be in danger. That's true.
But I guess you haven't gotten to your baryogenesis.
No. I mean, this will require a certain value of the field strength. I mean, if you're telling me that your additional effect does not allow one to ever reach that field strength,
right,
that would be a problem.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a time dependent thing that it's. I mean, my recollection is that basically, if you can never get very large magnetic fields from higher scale inflation, from lower scale inflation, you can. But then, I mean, I don't know what regime you want to be at. So there might be some region of the parameter space that works. So I guess that's something.
Yeah. I mean, the magnetic fields which you need for baryogenesis are not too large, actually. I mean, it's not like that you need a tremendously large magnetic field.
What's the difference between high and low for that person?
What scale would be the right one? Well, I mean, it depends on how many magnetic fields you need. So I think that the point is. order TV or 100 TV to TV somewhere. Yeah. But I mean, the thing is, I mean, this is a statement that how big a primordial magnetic unit is controversial. Like, the lower limit, that I mean, if you talk to Avery, for example, he says that this is not real, there's some other effects that are possible.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's a very large number, and I think if you want to get that number, this 10 to the minus, I don't know, 17 Gauss, mm-hmm. then I think you need to have, like, inflation less than a TeV. But if you don't want that big number, then... That's my recollection. That's what we
Yeah. Yeah. That. Okay. So if I understand correctly, I mean, what you've done is to study the product production during inflation. I think also the subsequent process of reheating is pretty hard to describe. And there, people are still doing lattice simulations to properly describe what's going on. So I think, I mean. Well, I mean, this is a first attempt to put everything together and then to see how you can get magnetic fields, baryogenesis, and gravitational waves, just to see that there is some interconnection, some correlation among those different phenomena. Basically, each of the different pieces in this puzzle still deserve to be looked at more carefully. Yeah. Okay, so I think I should speed up a little bit because we're running out of time. It's already a quarter to. Okay, I mean, if well, okay, so, well, I mean, according to at least our calculation, that's the final result we get. And here I've combined two different things. First of all, into this expression, this expression is based on our estimate of the magnetic fields at early times plus our description of the evolution after inflation. Okay, and then you see the dependence of this quantity in the parameter space as a function of xi, the instability parameter, and the Hubble rate h. Okay, and we reach values in between here 10 to the minus 20 Gauss and 10 to the minus 14 Gauss. This part of parameter space here is excluded because here we would transform more than 100% of the energy during inflation into the gauge field. So this is basically the very strong back reaction regime, which we can't describe consistently. But I mean, in another part of this parameter space here, all the perturbations, all the changes in the equations of motion stay at a very small level, and only a small fraction below a percent of the total energy during inflation goes into the gauge fields. Okay, well, those numbers are for sure consistent with the upper bound on the primordial gauge fields coming from the Planck collaboration. But looking at the anisotropies in the CMB, the ionization history of the universe, the Planck collaboration has inferred an upper bound on the strength of primordial magnetic fields of around 10 to the minus 9 Gauss. So we are certainly below this upper bound. And then I mentioned earlier that there are indications for an intergalactic magnetic field from the gamma ray observations of blazars. And that points to magnetic fields with a strength of the order 10 to the minus 17 to 10 to the minus 14 Gauss. And there's still a large part of parameter space where we are above those field strengths. Okay, so that's all I wanted to say about primordial magnetogenesis. And now in the next part of my talk, let me show to you how you can use those magnetic fields to implement a scenario of baryogenesis.
Just one quick question.
Yes?
If you apply the same reasoning to QCD type electromagnetic fields, what is the story for them?
Well, I mean,
your axiom was still coupled to FF2 trace.
Yeah.
And then you should have some similar story going on in the early part.
Well, I mean, maybe at early times you could generate a large field strength in the gluon field, but I mean, I think that would be gone, if I'm not mistaken, after the QCD phase transition. That would not survive the QCD phase transition.
Due to strong interaction with parity violation and all of that.
The answer is yes. People have looked at SU2 gauge fields. Yes.
Okay. So
yeah, but I mean,
it would generate large parity violation and strong interactions. Okay.
Yeah, but I mean, the I mean, none of those fields would have a chance to survive until the present day, right?
No, but you, I mean, so the magnetic field story would be gone, but people would build.
Sure, yeah. I mean, there are even models of inflation where you just, where you depend on the coupling of your inflaton field to SU2. That goes by the name of chromo natural inflation, because you have the coupling of the axion field to a non-imbuing gauge symmetry. So that works the same way, yes. Okay, good. So how can we use those magnetic fields for baryogenesis? The key ingredient here is that our magnetic fields, hypermagnetic fields, exhibit a non-zero helicity. Helicity here is defined as the product of A times B, the volume integral of A times B. I can decompose this into the different Fourier modes. And here we have the difference of positive helicity modes and negative helicity modes. I told you earlier that because of the parity violation during inflation, we mostly excite those states, the positive helicity modes. So those differences here will be non-zero. And then if we integrate our momentum, we will find that also the magnetic field exhibits a large non-zero helicity. And that gives us a new possibility, a new opportunity for baryogenesis. You're familiar with the fact that in the standard model, baryon number and lepton number L are not conserved. They are violated by changes in the SU2, the weak SU2 Chern-Simons number. So once I have diffusion of SU2 Chern-Simons number, sphaleron processes, instaton processes, this will violate baryon number and lepton number. But a similar statement also applies to changes in this equivalent quantity, changes in the hypermagnetic helicity. So once this quantity changes, it will create a change in baryon number and lepton number. Ng is nothing but the number of generations in the standard model. Okay, and that's a key property of the standard model, which we now can use for baryogenesis. Okay, so baryogenesis basically is a competition between different processes. We have B plus L production from this change in the hypermagnetic helicity. In fact, if you do the analysis, you see that the helicity per volume changes as a function of time as follows. So we've got this term here on the right-hand side, which is given in terms of the magnetic field strength B, and sigma is the conductivity of the thermal plasma in the early universe. If this conductivity was infinite, this term would just vanish, and the helicity would be perfectly conserved. But because the conductivity in the plasma is finite, this gives us some small non-vanishing term here on the right-hand side, and the helicity does vary in the course of the expansion. So there's going to be a small variation in the helicity, which will then source baryon number and lepton number via this anomaly equation. Okay. Here I'm showing a cartoon, a sketch of how baryogenesis proceeds in this model. I switch on my helical magnetic field. I will source baryon number through the anomaly. And well, then I create this baryon asymmetry. At some point, washout processes come into equilibrium. This B plus L asymmetry will be washed out again by the usual electroweak sphaleron processes, which happen at a certain rate, temperature-dependent rate in the plasma. Okay, so and then at later times, the asymmetry just evolves according to the balance among those production and washout processes, all the way down to the electroweak phase transition. And then it's a crucial question, which of those processes, production or washout, shuts off first. If the production shuts off first, the washout will still decrease the final asymmetry, and we will go down here. If both processes freeze out at the same time, the value will remain more or less constant. And conversely, if the washout becomes inactive first and the production still continues, there will be such an increase, an enhancement of the baryon asymmetry at late times. Okay. So to calculate the final value of the baryon asymmetry, it's crucial to understand how the production of bare number proceeds through the electroweak crossover. And in the corresponding kinetic equations, the Boltzmann equations, which describe this process, there's the important source term doing the electroweak crossover, which takes this form here. This curly H, again, is the hypermagnetic helicity. And theta W, as a function of T, is the time-dependent weak mixing angle through the electroweak crossover. Okay, so we see that non-zero helicity will source barrier number, but also variations in this in the weak mixing angle. Okay, so to solve the relevant kinetic equations and to calculate the final barrier asymmetry, it's important to know exactly how the weak mixing angle behaves as a function of temperature. Here in this plot, I'm showing to you different answers to this question. The dots with the arrow bars correspond to a numerical lattice simulation from 2 years ago, which studies the weak mixing angle as a function of temperature through the crossover. And then this black dashed line here corresponds to an analytical calculation from 20 years ago, where people have calculated the behavior of theta W during the phase transition. And you see that those results don't quite agree, this dashed curve and the black points. So it's important to improve on that. It would be desirable to have a better understanding of how the electroweak, weak mixing angle behaves as a function of temperature during the crossover. For the purposes of our study, we'll just model this temperature dependence in terms of a smooth step function, such a tangent hyperbolicus function here. And then we're able to evaluate this source term here doing inflation as a function of temperature, solve the kinetic equations, and determine the baryon asymmetry. And you see that this is the baryon asymmetry as a function of temperature during the electroweak crossover, and you see that there is a strong dependence of the solution depending on which model I take here to model the behavior of the weak mixing angle. Basically, those models differ by different values for those auxiliary parameters. The crossover is implemented at a time t step, where we put this smooth step function and a certain width delta t. And depending on which values you pick for delta t step and delta t, you will find a different behavior of the baryon asymmetry through the crossover. So that just shows that this entire analysis is still exhibits some uncertainty, and it suffers from this uncertainty, which comes from the poor understanding of the weak mixing angle as a function of temperature. Oh, I mean, you see the temperature here, and the temperature decreases during. So basically, I think it's.
On the right-hand
picture, which way is the time? Okay. I'm sorry. I mean, here.
That's 1 over temperature?
Here it's 1 over temperature, and here it's temperature.
Okay.
Yeah, so temperature decreases, so time is going from right to left. Initially, we have a hypermagnetic field, B field, and that's converted into an electromagnetic B field. Okay, and here it's the other way around. Time goes from left to right because this is proportional to 1 over T. Okay,
So can I ask? So basically, the main idea is that you need to have your magnetic field in place.
Yes.
By the electric field.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, I think the interesting feature here is that all the ingredients for baryogenesis are part of the standard model already. Yeah, so you generate the baryon asymmetry just because of this anomaly relation in the standard model. So basically, you don't need any new physics apart from the magnetic fields. You have to have some origin for those primordial magnetic fields, but once they are around, once they are in place at the time of the phase transition, you can generate the baryon asymmetry just based on standard model physics.
So unfortunately, I was just looking at our constraints, and our constraints said that they couldn't be basically a scale of inflation where you could produce magnetic fields would be less than, it was even less than GeV, it's more like.
Well, that's unfortunate because, yeah, I mean, the electric phase transition.
We are right, but yeah, so that's.
Yeah.
It's less than that.
I mean, the phase transition takes place at 100 GeV, right?
Yeah. Yeah,
I mean, in principle, you may wonder whether there's still a small window, but.
Maybe there's a bit of a problem.
Yeah, okay, good.
It's interesting that maybe it's more base trying to get around your bound, right?
So yeah, maybe there is a way, yeah.
Okay.
Just to make sure I understand it, that the thing that was driving it was E dot B, and you're saying that in the plasma, the rate of change of E dot B, you're getting the rate of change of E just because you're taking curl of B and you're using max of the base to figure out what E dot would have been. So there's nothing really magic going on. The electric fields you're getting are just really coming from the time change of your magnetic field, which you assumed you had.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, there's nothing beyond that. I mean, once those magnetic fields are in place, once they're produced, the further evolution is just described by Maxwell's equation. Yeah, that's it. Yeah, in that expanding plasma. Okay, good. So, well, the full numerical analysis requires one to solve a complicated system of kinetic equations, but it turns out that the full numerical result can be reproduced by such a simple approximate fit formula. So that's our outcome for the final baryon asymmetry. S, again, is the source term, which you saw on the previous slide here, okay? And then this source term has to compete with washout because of the electroweak sphalerons. And during the electroweak crossover, that's such an exponential function of the temperature. And then, those are just the gauge coupling constants in the standard model. Depending on which time evolution you assume for the weak mixing angle during the crossover, you then get a corresponding prediction for the baryon asymmetry. So now on this axis we have the baryon asymmetry, and you can plot this as a function of the field strength of the magnetic field, either at the time of the phase transition or the way it's done here in this plot. We see the baryon asymmetry as a function of the field strength in the present epoch. So 10 to the minus 10 is the number we want to achieve. That's the observed value for the baryon asymmetry. Those different colorful lines correspond to different ways to model the behavior of the weak mixing angle during the phase transition. And you see that depending on which model I go for, there's still a large uncertainty in the final baryon asymmetry. But the upshot is that to get a baryon asymmetry of 10 to the minus 10, of the order of 10 to the minus 10, we have to have a magnetic field with a strength around 10 to the minus, say, 10 to the minus 16 Gauss in the present epoch. So the observed baryon asymmetry is reproduced for such a field strength today, or equivalent, you can rephrase this as a field strength at the time of the electroweak phase transition. At that time, the B field has to have a strength of 0.1 GeV squared.
How sensitive is the final number of the baryon asymmetry to the reheating details, or was it all in the behavior of the weak mixing?
I mean, baryogenesis does not really know about the origin of the magnetic fields. It just requires that there's a magnetic field present with a certain strength, and that has to be the outcome of certain dynamics during inflation and certain dynamics during reheating. So I think from this perspective, it's not sensitive to reheating at all. It just requires that whatever happens at early times, the magnetic field has to have a strength of 0.1 GeV squared at the time of the electroweak phase transition. And then we made an attempt to show how this number can come about in certain models of axial inflation. I mean, maybe that needs to be refined or modified. But in the end, it's important that inflation plus reheating gives you a certain strength of this magnitude for the magnetic field.
Since you assume a model of inflation but not of reheating, do you assume instant reheating then?
That's what we do, yeah. I mean, to keep things simple, we work in the approximation of instant reheating. So when we describe the transition from inflation to the radiation-dominated era, we just work in the approximation where the entire energy from inflation is instantly converted into the energy in the radiation in the thermal bath. Okay, so I mean, this is basically an analysis which is local in time, and this doesn't require any knowledge about what's happening at earlier times. You just write down the equations, the Boltzmann equations, which come from the standard model, and you assume that there is a certain background value for your magnetic field. In fact, you can do this analysis without specifying where those magnetic fields come from. You just assume that there is a background magnetic field as an initial condition, and then you calculate the final baryon asymmetry, and that depends on the field strength for the magnetic field that you put in the beginning. Okay, that's now the next step. I mean, This is our requirement. This is our one condition, which comes from successful baryogenesis. So if we impose the condition of successful baryogenesis, we require that our magnetic field has this strength at the time of the electric phase transition. And that leads to the question, how can we obtain such a field strength from our mechanism of magnetogenesis? And that's where we can put things together now. Yeah. So, because we had an expression for the magnetic field strength as a function of our parameters xi and h, we can now ask for which values of xi and h do we get such values at the time of the phase transition? And then this gives us an estimate of the baryon asymmetry just as a function of those parameters xi and h. Okay, and this large uncertainty here in the prefactor comes from the uncertainty in the weak mixing angle. Yeah, just because we don't know how precisely how the weak mixing angle behaves as a function of temperature during the crossover. Okay, and now we can take this expression and plot it again in our parameter space, xi on this axis, h on this axis, and we see different contours for the baryon asymmetry. Those solid contours correspond to values towards the larger end here, and the dashed contours correspond to this pessimistic estimate. Okay, and that's why we not only get one line in parameter space, but we get a band in parameter space, taking into account this uncertainty here. Okay, but the uncertainty comes from the temperature dependence of the weak mixing angle during the crossover. Okay, so the conclusion or the prediction at this point is we are able to achieve successful baryogenesis mostly based on standard model physics only. What's happening at the electric weak phase transition is just standard model physics. New physics enters at earlier times during the process that generates those magnetic fields. Okay. Another prediction of this model is that the intergalactic magnetic fields must have a positive helicity. That's just because we observe a positive baryon asymmetry. If you carefully track all the signs in the calculation, if you look at the sign relation in the anomaly equation, you see that if I want to create a positive baryon number, then my change in the helicity has to be negative. That means I have to start at a positive helicity, which is decreasing. Okay. So the prediction of this model is that the intergalactic magnetic fields have a positive helicity. That's a precise and falsifiable prediction because in future observations, for instance, of the halo of blazars, that's something which can be tested, and there is hope that in such observations one could determine the helicity of the intergalactic magnetic fields, and then if it's negative, this mechanism is ruled out. If it's positive, then it's good from the perspective of this mechanism. Okay. However, I want to caution once again, our analysis comes with large uncertainties. We have not accounted for the effect of reheating. I mean, that's important now because now we plot the baryon asymmetry as our axial inflation parameters. And so this picture could be modified by a more careful analysis of reheating. And in principle, yeah, could also be modified if we take into account particle production during inflation. Okay, and again, it's uncertain because we don't know the exact behavior of the weak mixing angle during the phase transition. Okay, so in the last part, now let me show how this combined scenario of magnetic fields and baryogenesis can be probed in observations of gravitational waves. I mean, I'm out of time now, I guess, so maybe I should hurry up a little bit. I mean, we had a pretty long discussion already anyway, but good. So the point I want to make is that perturbations in the gauge field during inflation source perturbations in the metric that can be seen here in the equation of motion. H plus minus are certain polarization eigenstates of tensor perturbations in the metric. And on the right-hand side, again, we find a source term. Tij is an energy momentum tensor which is induced by gauge field, by the gauge fields. I can expand this here in momentum space, and E and B are the electric and magnetic field during inflation. Okay, then if you solve those equations and calculate the contribution to the spectral energy density in gravitational waves, you find that in addition to the usual piece which comes from the vacuum fluctuations during inflation, you find an additional contribution which is shown here in color, and that's an additional contribution to the gravitational wave spectrum which comes from this source term here, which comes from the perturbations in the gauge fields. Okay, and those functions FL and FR are just numerical functions, fit functions, which have been obtained in the literature. Okay, and so you notice that the usual vacuum contribution to the gravitational wave energy density goes as h squared, h over m Planck squared, and then this additional contribution goes as h over m Planck to the fourth power, which is a small number, but because the gauge fields and only the gauge fields are exponentially amplified, this small term is multiplied by such an exponential, e to the 4 pi xi, which can make this additional contribution large again and can lead to a situation where this additional piece even dominates over the usual vacuum contributions. Okay. Good. So basically, now I can take this expression here and evaluate this as a function of h and xi. You see this again here in our plot of parameter space. And on the left-hand side, where those contours are flat, the vacuum contribution dominates. And here, where those contours have a slope, the additional contribution from the gauge fields is dominant. Okay. And again, we see this green band, which corresponds to the requirement of successful baryogenesis. Okay, I should say a few words about this estimate here, because you asked the question. The requirement of successful baryogenesis tells us that at the end of inflation, I want to have a xi parameter of order, say, 4 or 5, somewhere here. Okay, so this combination of parameters should be, for this example, I'm just saying 5. Okay. At the same time now, I know that slow roll inflation ends once the slow roll parameter epsilon becomes of order unity, becomes large. Okay, so I know this combination of parameters must be of order 1. And I can solve those two equations for the scale lambda, which appears as the effective suppression scale in my axion gauge field coupling. So just based on those two simple estimates, I find that lambda should be given as m Planck over square root of 2 times the xi value at the end of inflation. And if xi at the end of inflation is, say, 5, then this evaluates to 3 times 10 to the 17 GeV. This is what gives us this estimate for the effective suppression scale. Okay, so we say that.
So then could you say that the axion would be an axion related to grand unification scale or something?
That's very speculative. I don't know. Yeah.
Scale is not
too far. Well, yeah, it's not. Yeah, I mean, this is just an example. I mean, if I cook up some inflationary model which ends somewhere here in parameter space, then this still changes. The point is, I mean, you would more expect maybe that the axion has an origin in string theory, because that would be close to your typical estimate of the string scale. 10 to the 17 GeV. I mean, the gut scale is still away by a factor 10, or 30 even, or whatever. Sorry, not necessarily. I mean, okay. At this point, it's just a number. Okay. I mean, we don't have any theory which gives us this number. It's just an outcome. Okay. But the point is that the axion, the inflator must be weakly coupled because this is a large energy scale. If we increase the coupling, then we would go to this part of parameter space here, and there we would find overproduction of baryon number. Okay, and because we have such a strong suppression scale, we automatically always stay in the weak field regime. The gauge field production during inflation never dominates the inflationary dynamics. If you look at the equations of motion that I showed in the very beginning, the new terms induced by the gauge field coupling, the contribution to the total energy density always stays small with such a large suppression scale. Okay, good. And Now, on my second to last slide, I want to show how different inflationary models now give rise to specific predictions for the gravitational wave spectrum. So I've been showing this plot over and over again with xi on this axis and h on this axis. Now for each inflationary model, you basically have to think about how those numbers, xi and h, vary during inflation. So what we want to do is look at the trajectories of given inflationary models in the xi h parameter plane. And then here I'm just giving an example for natural inflation. That's a cosine potential. And at very early times, the Hubble rate is very large and xi is very small. And then as the number of e-folds decreases, I'm going from number of e-folds around 50 to zero, my Hubble rate drops, decreases, and my parameter xi also becomes larger. And that leads me along this trajectory here in the parameter space. And as I go along this trajectory, I can read off the corresponding values for the strength in gravitational waves as a function of this number of e-folds. That's shown here on the right-hand side in this plot. I'm showing omega gravitational waves on the vertical axis, and the number of e-folds towards the end of inflation on the horizontal axis. And we see that once we go along this part of the trajectory, that the strength in gravitational waves drastically increases. So this is associated with the explosive gauge field production at the end of inflation. And that's also at the same time a strong generation of gravitational waves. And that results in this peak in the spectrum towards the end of inflation. So basically, this production mechanism for the gauge fields leaves an imprint in the spectrum of gravitational waves. Here I'm putting a big question mark because we don't study the process of reheating. It's not quite clear how this curve continues. I mean, for sure, we don't have such a strong production of gravitational waves anymore after inflation, so this peak should fall off somehow. But yeah, there should be different possibilities for how this happens exactly. Okay, good. And now, right. What I've shown to you so far is our calculation of the magnetic field as a function of xi and h. I've calculated the baryon asymmetry as a function of xi and h, and we calculated the strength in gravitational waves as a function of xi and h. And now we can basically solve those relations and trade a few parameters. We can trade the dependence on xi and h for a dependence on the magnetic field strength and the frequency at which this peak at the end of inflation occurs. And eventually, if you do this analysis, you find an expression for the magnetic field strength as a function of your strength of the peak in the gravitational wave spectrum and the frequency at which this peak occurs. And that's shown here in this plot. So now this plot combines everything that I've been talking about up to this point. We see the strength in the gravitational waves at the peak that we expect at the end of inflation as a function of the peak frequency. And those contours here correspond to different values of the magnetic field. And then the magnetic field has to have a certain strength so that we have successful baryogenesis at the electroweak scale. Okay, and so the outcome of this entire analysis is that we expect a weak signal in gravitational waves at high frequencies. That's hard to detect, but in principle, this would be a unique signature of baryogenesis, a specific mechanism of baryogenesis via decaying helicity. Aimed for a stronger signal in gravitational waves, this would correspond to an overproduction of baryon number in this model. Okay, so I think my time is up, and it's time to conclude. Let me show you to you again my very first slide. I considered this coupling of an axion inflaton field to gauge fields during inflation. We identified those gauge fields as the gauge fields of the hypercharge sector in the standard model. and that entails a rich phenomenology. I was talking about primordial magnetogenesis. We use those magnetic fields for baryogenesis via the chiral anomaly in the standard model, and that production mechanism of gauge fields feeds back into the tensor spectrum and gives us a signal in stochastic gravitational waves. Our main results are as follows. Baryogenesis is indeed feasible for a weakly coupled pseudoscalar field. If we require that the baryon asymmetry comes out as 10 to the minus 10, the magnetic field has to have a strength of the order of 10 to the minus 16 Gauss, and that corresponds to a suppression scale of the order of 3 times 10 to the 17 GeV. Okay, so this production of magnetic fields is associated with a peak in the gravitational wave spectrum at very large frequencies in the megahertz range that's out of reach of present day technology, but in principle it could serve as a smoking gun signal for baryogenesis via decaying helicity. That's all I wanted to say, and thank you for your attention.
Well, I think we've had quite a few questions already.
Yeah, that's true.